What are you looking at?
Oh, the shorts, they're so funny. All these animals.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, you need to see it.
No, stop trying to distract me with cute cat videos.
Okay, I'm putting it down, I promise. I'm not looking at my phone.
Yes, you are. I can see you.
Okay, I'm paying attention.
Actually, can we watch that last video again? That was really cute.
Yeah, of course you can.
Wait, no. It's happening again.
Okay. Paying attention.
All right, we're focusing. We're not neurodivergent. We're just like everyone else.
Yes, we know how to stay on focus.
Maybe today's book will help us learn how to avoid getting so easily distracted.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Okay. Welcome to Thriving Between the Lines, the podcast that examines personal development books through the lens of intersectionality, making self-help content more accessible and relatable. I am life coach and shiny object, Leslie Crudup Villa Garcia.
And I'm Mika, a magpie for all rainbow things.
And together, we're not just reading between the lines,
we're thriving between the lines.
And today, as usual, we are coming to you from Mianjin, or Brisbane, land of the Yagara and Turrbal people, where sovereignty has never been ceded, and it always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land. All right, Mika, when you run into books or media that claim to teach you how to stay focused, how does that make you feel?
A little patronized, a bit like, hey, maybe you should go tell the doctors. They've been trying to do this for years.
You mean you don't look at it and go, oh, finally, this is the solution?
I don't stick my nose up at it immediately. I have a look, I try it out, and I have to say, occasionally there are things that even though they don't make me not distractible, it is that they maybe help a little bit or are a tiny piece of a big puzzle.
Okay. So on that note, what is today's book, Mika?
Indistractable: How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life by Nir Eyal.
Excellent. Thank you. Now, to have a truly authentic conversation about this book, we cannot discuss it in isolation, right?
No.
And this is something we've talked about a little bit, but we're going to dive into during this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I saw this book, or first heard about this book, which was actually through a different book, I was kind of like, I originally heard about this book through another book, Stolen Focus by Johan Hari.
Oh.
Right. Yep. Yeah, Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention. A very, very good book. Mm-hmm. I actually really love that book. It was one of my favorite book club discussions as well. But one of the things that he highlighted in the book was the fact that Nir Eyal, before publishing Indistractable, published another book on a very different topic, but related. And what was that book called?
Hooked: How to Build Habit-Forming Products.
Yeah. So the guy, he's, you know, Nir Eyal, he's very, very influential in tech circles, in Silicon Valley, in business circles. Any big players in the product creation world know who this guy is. They've read Hooked, or they've discussed the Hooked model, and they're like, okay, this is the guy who is the expert on how to keep people hooked on things.
Yes, and it's kind of like, well, we're going to take advantage of people who are able to get distracted easily and even take that product so far as that we can distract people that have regular levels of attention. So it affects people with already struggling attention span issues more so than your average people.
Mm. Yeah.
which I find particularly irritating.
Yeah. So as the understanding that some of these technologies are very distracting and can interrupt people's lives and people are becoming addicted, it's like it goes, well, I can sell you the solution to the problem that I helped create.
Yes, exactly. It seems a little dodgy, really.
Yeah.
It's like setting fire to a place and then being like, hey, I got a fire engine.
Yeah.
Probably like the Murdoch media, how they like to rile people up so that they get better stories of people being riled up to show how much they're terrible people.
It sells papers, you know? Whatever you're going to do to sell books and sell papers.
The sweet, sweet morals of a capitalist society.
Yeah. Oh, how we love it. One thing that's tricky, though, is that, like, when I was engaging in my own dive into Eyal's history and his influence in Silicon Valley, et cetera, it was hard to really measure. Like, if we had to make a pie chart of who's responsible for people's technology, like, dependence on technologies and that kind of thing, it's not completely clear, like, what the cause and effect relationship is when we look at each of these little habit-forming technologies and products, right? So I think the easiest way forward for our discussion is to just blame him for everything.
I think that makes it easier. He's had a lot of influence in that space.
Yeah. But I think we can go beyond like the technology space as well. So I've been blaming him for everything. I'm like, okay, I really hate when Nir Eyal comes into my house and undoes all my laundry. I'm like, what the hell, dude?
He takes your spare steak, takes one sock out of every pair.
Oh, takes one piece out of every jigsaw puzzle. Undoes all my dusting.
Yeah. They're making dirty dishes.
Yeah. One of the reasons we're making this podcast is to highlight one common problematic element in not all of these books, but a lot of these books. And that is the overemphasis on personal responsibility with a dismissal of some of the causes of the problems that people are facing.
Or him taking his own personal responsibility for causing the problems he's trying to solve.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that is not to say that this book has no value, right? Because I thought there were some very useful, very practical tips in this book. And I know that you had similar feelings.
Yeah, I've certainly got some notes that on the useful points. Admittedly, a lot of those are drawn from established psychological practices, which we'll go into. But yeah, it's a way of, I guess, sharing it to the masses.
Yeah, there are some things that I actually took from it and I was like, I can implement this right away because I think it will help me. The problem, of course, is that in a lot of cases, he writes in absolutes.
Yes.
And really lays it on thick with the, like, you need to take responsibility for your own life. Like, it's about you. It's not about the systems. It's not about the product. It's your fault.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple of, I'm going to read you a couple of bits from the book that really set the tone for the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So page 3 gives us a good example of this already. This is in the introduction. He writes, in the future, there will be two kinds of people in the world. Those who let their attention and lives be controlled and coerced by others, and those who proudly call themselves indistractable. By opening this book, you've taken the first step to owning your time and your future. It's like, there'll be two kinds of people in the world. And he even gives this group that he's trying to create, he gives them a label. Indistractable. So right away it's like, my desire to be included, my desire to be along gets triggered by this whole idea. It's like, okay, now I'm going to look at the approaches in this book as a way to be part of a tribe of people who mm-hmm. are, you know, the indistractable.
The haves and the have-nots.
Yeah. The have attention spans and the have not attention spans.
Yeah.
Mm. And in the next little paragraph, he goes on to say, but you're just getting started. For years, you've been conditioned to expect instant gratification. Think of getting to the last page of Indistractable as a personal challenge to liberate your mind. Again, it's like using this like power language, like liberate your mind. As a way, ironically, to distract the readers from the fact that he has been part of this problem.
Mm-hmm.
In yep. a way that he just will not implicate himself for.
Yes. The way it's kind of made like a, if you're not 100% indistractable, it's not good enough. Like he's not yep. saying being less distractible is a good thing to obtain as well. You're not part of the tribe if you're only less distractible. You're only part of the tribe if you're indistractable.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Setting us up for these two very distinct options.
Yeah. I hate absolutes and black and whites. Like, it just doesn't go down my type of mindset.
Yeah. And I kind of want to fix this wording for him. So where he says, those who let their attention and lives be controlled and coerced by others. It's like, no. Controlled and coerced by you. It should mm-hmm. say, who let their attention and lives be controlled and coerced by people like me.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, it just doesn't come up in the book at all.
Mm-hmm.
Even where he talks about Hooked, in a way, that's an opportunity to say, hey, I recognize that there are big, powerful forces, a lot of whom have been influenced by me and the work of other people like me. And, you know, we didn't really know what we were creating. Like, we didn't have an idea of, like, the kinds of rabbit holes people might fall into, the social implications. There was none of that. It was just like, yeah, I wrote this book. It was really successful. And now we're going to talk about this.
Yeah. It's a, kind of reminds me of like maybe Darth Vader doing a talk on how to avoid being a victim of the Empire.
Exactly. To come out and publicly acknowledge his part in all of this, I don't think that would undermine the message of the book. I think if anything else, it would make it much stronger.
Yeah, like, I'm sure at the beginning they weren't planning to create these algorithm monsters that are out there trying to destroy human attention.
Mm-hmm.
But it's okay to admit, like, oh yeah, it totally got away from us. It's bigger than I ever thought it would be.
Yeah, that would at least put more of a sense of humanity into the whole discussion.
Yeah.
In fact, not only that, but he critiques other influential thinkers in this space who do put the onus more on the technologies and the technology companies. So one of these mm-hmm. people is Tristan Harris, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Tristan Harris, he comes up a lot in conversations around technology, ethics, the design of products. He was in, have you seen The Social Dilemma on Netflix, that documentary?
I have seen bits of it.
Okay, it's definitely worth watching because it explores this rabbit holing of society and the impacts of social media and how these technologies have kind of gotten away from us and become
mm-hmm.
bigger than we could have imagined, really. And I have to say, I do have a little bit of a nerd crush on Tristan Harris. He's such a cutie pie. Like, he's just adorable. Every time I see him aww. Pop up on like a blog or something, I'm like, oh, there he is again. Yeah. My partner would look at him and go, yep, that's your type, Leslie. It's like, yep, he's my type. But anyway, yeah. Early in his career, he was working at Google as a design ethicist. Had a mm-hmm. lot of, you know, challenging feelings about the ethics of what was happening at Google, broke off to do his own thing, and co-founded the Center for Humane Technology.
Mm.
Now, you would think that Nir Eyal or people of his ilk would look to Tristan Harris and people like him for those cautionary tales about what's being created. But instead, there's kind of this rivalry in a way. I don't know if it's a mutual rivalry or if it's just Nir Eyal like bashing Tristan Harris's work or anything. But he kind of poo-poos the idea that the companies and the designers need to change and check themselves and says, nope, it's the individuals, it's the users, it's about personal responsibility. Like, we've got things to shut off our notifications. Like, we've got buttons we can press. We can put timers on shit. It's like, it's easy. Come on, people. That's the attitude that kind of comes through when you kind of, you know, catch him with his makeup off, so to speak, really honestly talking about these things.
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with the fact that all of that is extra labor as well in our lives, that this problem we're having in the modern world where there's just so much more labor in day-to-day going on that we are getting overwhelmed.
Yes.
For me, the only option has been to just totally, like, decide at times when I'm feeling too overwhelmed, I'm just not going near things like that.
You're not going near it, you say? Sorry.
Which is a real problem if you...
I all apologize for that bad pun I just made.
No, Leslie, no.
Hey, if you had made that joke, I would have gone, oh, Mika, you're so adorable.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You just expect more from me, is that it?
Yeah, you're a lot smarter than I am. Now I've forgotten exactly what I was going to say.
See, this is something that we can legitimately blame Nir Eyal for. It's like, dude, your name distracted us.
Yeah. Something, social media too distracting, have to stay away from it.
You won't go near it.
But if you have a business or things like that, you don't have the option to not go near it. And then it's during your work hours and you got to kind of have this superhuman ability to be there to do all your work without getting distracted by all the other stuff that's being shoved in your face.
Yes. And we will definitely dive into all the stuff related to work interruptions and such. So I want to go through some of the main sections of this book, talk about... the most prominent themes, and we'll react to those things from our perspectives as people who understand the need for intersectionality to be considered. All right, so shall we dive in?
Let's go.
All right. The indistractable model. So he mentions the main components of becoming indistractable, becoming part of the indistractable tribe. When we look at his model for being indistractable, so when we look at the key components of being indistractable, the first focus is mastering internal triggers and then making time for traction, traction being the inverse of distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's about hacking back external triggers. So that's where we get into like how we manage like some of the outside things that are competing for our attention. But let's talk about internal triggers. What do you got?
Yeah, I find this interesting because if we go back and look at the hooked definition of internal triggers, they're saying like that's what someone really wants, like your desires. And I'm kind of like, okay, so we're saying we need to stop having desires for things or mastering those desires to be more in line with a world that is constantly trying to steal your attention.
Mm-hmm. It's like, just don't desire those things. Done.
Like, oh, I desire human connection. Most of that's done now through social media, but I find it too difficult to navigate. So now I don't get to have that desire.
Yeah. And in this one, like, there is more validation of our internal desires being a trigger for seeking comfort in scrolling through an app or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's trying to offer us in this chapter is ways to respond to those internal triggers a little bit differently so that you don't then go off track.
Okay. Yeah, I can see how you can adapt your internal desires to be acted upon differently, where you kind of go, oh, well, I'm going to actually go out and see someone in real life instead of going on social media, so things like that.
Yeah. And I agree that when we really tap into our deepest core values, I would like to think that most of us would not find that the way to live those values is to just stare at a screen all day long.
Yeah. And yeah. I think it's important to recognize from our point of view too, that not everyone is instinctual at looking at the cause of their actions. So like I've just been trained over a long period of therapy and self-development to kind of look at why I'm doing a behavior or an action. And instinctually I'll be then able to recognize, oh, I'm trying to fulfill this need. I need to go and change the way I fulfill it.
Yeah. It's not always a simple thing to do for a lot of people to understand what is internally driving them towards some of these, towards any particular behavior, let alone one that is powered by billions and billions of dollars of engineering and development behind it that is actively trying to keep your attention.
Exactly. It takes a lot of practice to become instinctual at that habit.
Yeah. So I think it's safe to say that we agree that it's not wrong to say there's something inside of you that's causing you to do something that might be distracting you from what you really believe you should be doing, but it's covered in a very surface level way in this book.
And I think what I hold against him there too is that it didn't used to be hard for some of these needs to be fulfilled the natural way, and we're now having to fight against the products that they've developed.
Yeah.
To fulfill that need, because they're stealing it. It's like how mom and pop shops have been destroyed by big box stores. They're destroying these smaller like human interactions by taking them over with their apps, with their products.
Yeah. So when we desire things like human connection, I mean, that's like a very relatable, very universal issue in all of this across cultures, to be able to nurture the kinds of connections that we were able to in previous generations, it takes more than us as individuals saying, you know what, I'm going to opt out of all the time that I spend on social media. I'm going to reduce it down to almost zero or complete zero and just expect that there will be people there waiting for you to join you on this mission and to connect with you. Like, you kind of have to have like a group pact around it.
Yeah, or make new friends, and you're going to lose friends along the way.
Yeah.
And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah. And there are so many things to consider if you are going to make that huge social shift. I know that there was a period of like a couple of years where I was on Facebook. I still had an account, but I would barely look at it. And one thing that was very like frustrating about that was that people around me, or you know, people I worked with or something, there was this assumption that I knew what was going on with them because they'd posted about it on Facebook. I'm like, look, I rarely ever look at my Facebook. So no, I did not know that you were pregnant. So you're not really allowed to get angry at me for not congratulating you. It's like, oh, yeah. I posted it on Facebook. It's like,
yeah, I've had it quite a bit recently where people are like, oh, but I posted about it. I'm like, I don't have the time to look at everyone's posts. Like, they probably don't understand how many people I have on social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I do have fairly wide social circles who I do still see in person fairly regularly. So it's unrealistic to be like, well, just unfriend all the people you don't really talk to. Well, that is quite a lot of people still.
And I think that's something that'll come up periodically throughout this discussion, like the actual impacts of utilizing some of these methods for spending less time on our devices and so forth. One of the issues that I had when I was barely on social media, it was constantly having to explain to people why I didn't know what was going on in their life. in a way that it was like I was self-selecting myself out of the loop. And
yes.
As much as it would have been great to like catch up with someone and say, oh, hey, how have you been? And then it's like, what do you mean? Like, I've been posting absolutely every update of my life for the last 2 years and you've missed it because you've been too busy living your life. And it creates this weird tension that ideally shouldn't be there, but it is. So I was out of the loop, and it did cause a little bit of tension with some people on the rare occasion that we like did connect outside of social media. And these are things to consider before we get too deep into that stuff. He takes the opportunity again to remind us that we are the problem and the products aren't the problem. On page 26, he writes, most people don't want to acknowledge the uncomfortable truth that distraction is always an unhealthy escape from reality. How we deal with uncomfortable internal triggers determines whether we pursue healthful acts of traction or self-defeating distractions. It's like, hang on a minute. So distraction is always an unhealthy escape from reality. How exactly are we defining reality here? That's one of my big questions.
Yeah. Like, the first thing that comes to mind with a distraction is your kid coming in and talking to you when you were trying to do something else. I don't think it's unhealthy for your child to distract you. And my personal experience with distraction is quite different to what he describes in the book as well. Mm. In that, yeah, it's... I don't know if it's specific to ADHD, my personal experience, but often my distractions are more so that I'm finding it. I need big blocks of time to do the things I need to do, the important things, because once I start it, it is horrifyingly painful to get ripped out of it.
Mm.
It's so annoying once I'm in a hyperfocus for someone to come and then break it, or me have an appointment I need to go to. I also know that if I get into a hyperfocus, I'm going to totally forget about my appointment.
Mm-hmm.
So my distraction is more a delay towards the thing I actually want or need to be doing, because I know I don't have enough time in this specific moment to do it the way I need to do it.
Mm.
Some people are able to just, oh, I'm just going to do an hour's worth of this thing and then get back to it. It takes me like half an hour to wind up and start my brain going, because inertia is one of my issues.
Yeah.
And once I'm going, it's very frustrating to have to stop. And it really gets me very little progress.
Yeah.
And so my distractions are usually like the world doesn't fit into my way of thinking. So I'm delaying. I'm in waiting mode trying to get to an appointment or finish this other thing that, you know. It's I would not say that my distractions are an unhealthy escape from reality.
Yeah. It would be really easy for someone to say, oh, well, you're clearly taking that paragraph out of context. And it's like, okay, look, this is one small paragraph in a big book about being distracted, but this is where the way things are worded matters. When we say distraction is always an unhealthy escape from reality, for some people, it's the inverse. Sometimes people have to distract themselves in a way to stay healthy in a very dark reality.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. But also, and this is kind of a spoiler for anyone wondering like, I wonder what he has to say about ADHD, autism, such and such in all of this. Never once mentioned the idea of neurodivergence issues linked to being unable to focus on a particular thing. Never once mentioned.
I did notice that.
when I picked up this book, much like any books related to focus, my brain went into control F mode. It's like, I want to see the first mention of these things. And it never came. It never came.
I was expecting when I purchased this book for there to be some sort of disclaimer, like this isn't for people with ADHD or like specific issues towards attention.
Yeah.
But of course.
The way he writes about people is very, like, it's like he's writing about one person, just using a bunch of different examples relating to this one very particular type of person. So
himself.
Himself, people he knows, you know, other Silicon Valley types, who knows? Like, a lot of the people that are mentioned in this book are people with a high amount of privilege, very high income, high level of education. It doesn't really, like, there's nothing intersectional about any of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And I wanted to get your take on one of the techniques mentioned for managing internal triggers, because it's one that comes up a lot in any kind of therapeutic modalities. Let me just find it. He cites the work of Dr. Jonathan Bricker in the section on reimagining the internal trigger. And the four basic steps he mentions are: look for the discomfort that precedes the distraction, focusing in on the internal trigger. All right. Step two, write down the trigger. Step three, explore your sensations. And step four, beware of liminal moments. Okay. So he mentions one of the ways in which we can explore our sensations in this paragraph, which I will read to you now. It's page 41. One of Bricker's favorite techniques is the leaves on a stream method. When feeling the uncomfortable internal trigger to do something you'd rather not, imagine you are seated beside a gently flowing stream, he says. Then imagine there are leaves floating down that stream. Place each thought in your mind on each leaf. It could be a memory, a word, a worry, an image. And let each of those leaves float down that stream, swirling away as you sit and just watch.
Yes, I have something to say about this.
Okay, what do you have to say about this?
So this comes from the ACTS model in psychology, I believe. And one of the important steps of it is not to place each thought onto a leaf, but to inspect each thought, like understand it, inspect it, and then let it go. It's about like reducing rumination and like getting into these spiral, like circuits of thought where you just keep going over it. You need to inspect each memory or thought to understand why it's coming up, or just give it a little more attention, because thoughts come up because they want attention from you. Mm-hmm. And so you have to actually give it a little bit of attention and then say, that's enough. Like, I have looked at you, now I don't need you right now. Mm. And so you can't just be like, oh, eject all thoughts, put them on your leaves. He's just skipped the step that I find very important about that model.
Yeah. And this is the kind of model that even when I think about clients that I've worked with, where we're using elements of ACT and stuff firmly within the bounds of coaching, because I don't pretend to be a therapist. Like, you have to have solid agreement with your client that they want to engage in this kind of thing for it to be effective at all, right? But it can be very effective for certain purposes, like what you've described. But the way it's written here, as you said, feels very dismissive.
Yes.
Just put your thoughts on these leaves. Let them flow down the river. It's like, shit. Now it kind of increases my cognitive load, because now I'm like, oh, shit, what do I actually need to keep in my mind? What do I need to remember? What can I do with these thoughts?
Yes.
Yeah. One thing I found helpful in this section was step four, beware of liminal moments. All right. So the paragraph starts, liminal moments are transitions from one thing to the other throughout our day. Have you ever picked up your phone while waiting for a traffic light to change, then found yourself still looking at your phone while driving? Like, that's a whole other problematic conversation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, or opened a tab in your web browser, got annoyed by how long it's taking to load, and opened up another page while you waited? Or looked at a social media app while walking from one meeting to the next, only to keep scrolling when you got back to your desk. You know, he provides some examples like that. And I definitely can relate to that. Not the phone in the car thing. Like, I don't touch my phone in the car when I'm driving. But it's these other moments where it's like, oh, I'll just scroll through my phone while I'm walking from the bedroom to the kitchen. But then I don't quite get started on what I wanted to do when I get to the kitchen. or, you know, walking from my car to the office. And it's like, okay, I can look at these things and go, this is where I need to get better at not getting distracted by stuff. Being more honest with myself about what is triggering that need to have this constant stimulation and replace it with some action or habit that's healthier.
Yeah.
And one thing that he mentions in this section is the concept of surfing the urge. Mm. How do you go with urge surfing?
Interesting perspective. I guess I have got better at it, but it's very hard. And like, my urges aren't based on avoiding a discomfort. They're based on an excitement about something else. Like, I just get excited about everything, and I actually like focus too much on different things. It's not lack of attention. It's lack of attention on the thing you're supposed to pay attention to.
Oh, but it's always an unhealthy escape from reality, Mika. Always.
Because the world's full of interesting things and there's lots of cool stuff to do. And my problem is, like, it might be a great thing to do. It might even be something that's valid, but you can only do so much as a person. So it's more me. I don't like surf the urge and be like, oh, just resist the urge. I have to sit there and think, okay, why is it more important to do this other thing? Why is this thing not something I should action immediately? Write it down. You can come back to it later. It's less of just, oh, I don't get the jitters for hopping on social media or getting on any of these like scrolling mindless things, really. I don't really enjoy them. I get stuck in them and I hate it. I don't even enjoy it. But I don't have to sit there being like, oh, like, don't go and do that thing because it's terrible. I would have more of that problem with other kind of addictive type things, but not in regards to attention.
Yeah, I think surfing the urge can be, it can be helpful. Like, when you've got that urge that pops up, just visualizing it from a place of curiosity and like having the time, telling yourself, utilizing the 10-minute rule, as they call it, and saying, I'm going to wait 10 minutes before I give into that. Like, in theory and in some contexts, that can work really well. But if you've got a different kind of mind, or depending on the urge, it might just fall flat completely, especially if those internal triggers are based on something that really could benefit from like professional exploration. It's speaking to a therapist, speaking to a counselor, speaking to a coach to really dive into what those things are before you try to just like shut everything out.
Yep.
But again, doesn't dive into that. Very much stays on the surface. And one thing that's a little disappointing about that is that a lot of, just because of the nature of technology, a lot of the specific tips that are offered in this book will become outdated very quickly.
Yeah.
there are specific programs, specific apps that are mentioned. I haven't even examined all of them to see if like they all still exist. But it's like, you could have cut out a lot of that in favor of diving into the more important stuff. And I think that's one of the, that is one of the key critiques of this book as well in the book reviewer world. People liken it to a bunch of blog posts just stuck together.
Yeah. Which, it's quite a short book as well. There was room.
Yeah, there was room. I appreciated that it didn't take very long to read it. I appreciated that, like, I don't mind when books kind of feel like a bunch of blog posts stuck together because, you know, sometimes I'm not going to dive into someone's whole blogging history to get what they're about. It's like, just put all your blog posts in a book. I'll read the book. The end. Like, that can work really well, actually. But it's not evergreen content by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
So we can reimagine our internal triggers. We can dive into our internal triggers. But if we haven't really properly examined them then we could be putting a Band-Aid on a zombie bite.
Yes.
It's like...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or actually ignoring the thing that is actually more important. We often misjudge what's important and not important in life. And if you don't inspect those urges that come by, you might be missing a signal your body's trying to tell you of something that you need.
Yeah. Let's talk about making time for traction.
That sounds good.
Time boxing.
Mm-hmm.
When I say that word to you, Mika, what comes to mind?
Irritation at being pulled out of a hyperfocus.
Well, yeah. So it's a way of scheduling your time so that every hour, every minute, or however, whatever increments you want, are accounted for in some way. So yeah. If you've got like a schedule for the week where you've got like your main appointments and your important obligations, that's one thing. But with time boxing, what is recommended is basically leaving like no white space. That's how a lot of people approach it, where you do schedule in time for things like scrolling social media or, you know, running around outside with your kid. And the general idea is that it doesn't really matter as much what you're doing with your time as long as you are honoring the agreement that you have made with yourself about how your time will be spent.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people really like time boxing. I really like time boxing in theory.
It's so labor intensive. Like,
yeah.
Set it up. And then the second something like comes and disturbs it, there's emergencies or sudden changes. It just, you have to go and do all the admin again. And I don't have time for it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, I love the idea of saying, I'm going to spend only this amount of time, like, you know, 1 hour a day on social media for personal purposes and professional purposes, you know, and from 6 to 6:30, I'm going to have a chat with my partner about, I don't know, the economy or or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I like the idea of being able to plan all of those things ahead. I don't like this note. Like, some people are so into time boxing that they kind of, they get really judgmental about people who don't have, like, complete, like, bulletproof schedules. And they're like, oh, it's because you haven't scheduled your day properly that's why you're, you know, a quote-unquote failure. It's like, hang on a minute. Time boxing is just one possible method for having control over your time, but it doesn't work for everyone. It's not appropriate for everyone. And even where it can be helpful, there are other considerations and other things that you can incorporate that'll help you accomplish what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And I have to say, I do have to do something similar when I'm trying to establish a routine or get back into health habits.
Mm.
But it's kind of like key things like meals and wake up sleep times, things like that. And then I have blocks of time where it's to achieve one of the goals of the day. But I can do those in whichever order. And
yeah,
it's not quite as official.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what Nir Eyal has written here about time boxing. He writes, you can't call something a distraction unless you know what it's distracting you from. All right. I know many of us bristle at the idea of keeping a schedule because we don't want to feel hampered. But, oddly enough, we actually perform better under constraints. That is often true for me.
Yeah.
This is because limitations give us a structure, while a blank schedule and a mile-long to-do list torment us with too many choices. Again, there's validity there.
Yeah.
The most effective way to make time for traction is through time boxing. Time boxing uses a well-researched technique psychologists call setting an implementation intention, which is a fancy way of saying deciding what you're going to do and when you're going to do it. It's a technique that can be used to make time for traction in each of your life domains. Okay. Now, if you're doing that as a way to visualize, one thing that's really helpful about that is that you can kind of visualize and like have an at-a-glance piece of evidence of what you're prioritizing in your day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it goes on to describe it a little bit. You know, he talks about making time to watch videos or to take a nap, but then finishes off the paragraph saying, keeping a time-boxed schedule is the only way to know if you're distracted. If you're not spending your time doing what you'd planned, you're off track. And it's that way of saying it's the only way to know if you're distracted.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know that that's true.
No, I think that that's very much maybe his experience, but I certainly know if I'm distracted within, you know, a few hours, I can notice that I'm not achieving the things I'm supposed to. Mm. Another point that came up with that is that very much sounds like for someone with a regular work schedule and normal work hours that are the same every week, it might be not that labor intensive, but for people with crazy rosters, you know, you don't find out till they put out the roster on Sunday for the next week. You don't know till Sunday what your roster is for the rest of the week. And so you're going to be there like rushing to try and fix up your time boxes.
Yeah.
For the rest of the week. It's a lot more labor for someone who doesn't have that 9-to-5 sort of lifestyle.
Yeah. And the implication, again, in here is clear. If you're not time boxing, if you're not making sure that you're never distracted, you're doing something wrong. If you're not having complete control over your own schedule, you are not doing something right. You don't have enough power. And it's like, well, don't know about that, bro.
Yeah.
So, and because one of the purposes of this podcast is to try to make these concepts more relatable and like adjust them for people, like I'm not saying don't try time boxing.
Mm.
Give it a try. Like it could actually bring you a lot of joy.
Yes.
You know? But do not beat yourself up if you don't nail it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Don't beat yourself up if these other things keep popping up and in making you feel like you failed somehow. It's like, no.
Yes.
Some of these things are a trial and error process. If you can only just block out time for what you understand are your most important like tasks to prioritize, that is still a win.
Yes.
If there are just three things that you want to do in a day and anything else can kind of like wrap itself around that, put those things on your schedule. Decide when you're going to do them. And give yourself some friggin' grace around it. Especially nowadays. There's just so much going on that it's like people are still trying to play catch up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And having a closer look at how you're scheduling your time can also make it easier for you to schedule your important relationships.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that can give people a bit of an ick when it's like, what, are you really going to schedule specific time to have a snuggle on the couch with your partner? For some people, that can feel really weird. But for others, it's like, well, why not?
I forget to do it.
Yeah. You might get to the end of a month or a year and go, oh my gosh, you know, we haven't kissed at all. Mm-hmm. But like, if you put it in your schedule, like, we're going to have a cute little makeout session, it might seem like you're about to suck out all the spontaneity and romance from your relationship. But if you look at it a different way, it's like, it can be nice to say, no, this is an immovable item on the schedule. Nothing is going to interrupt this.
Yeah.
Like, I'm giving that time to you. Mm-hmm. It can be a way to communicate to your partner or whoever else you're trying to interact with that, like, they are so important to you that you are making this time for them.
Yes.
And removing that vagueness around, like, Oh, no, but you should just drop everything to spend whatever time with me that I need. Otherwise, I won't feel loved. Because, yeah. You know, you're not speaking my love language of quality time. And it's like, well, you know, my love language is time boxing. Sorry, babe.
I do actually find it more important for things like that to schedule it in than getting other important tasks done.
Mm. Yeah. I might actually play around with that a bit.
Yeah.
Mm. So the various things around time boxing, around scheduling, around things like that, it can be really hit or miss depending on the context. Some things will work really well for some people in some circumstances, and for other people it's just like, nope, in the bin, done.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But let's transition now to the section on hacking back external triggers. Because this is a huge issue with people who are like, well, you know what? Like, I can have all of my internal triggers sorted, but there are all these other things demanding my attention. What the hell am I supposed to do about that, Leslie? It's like, okay, well, Nir Eyal has the solution, doesn't he? Do you have anything that you do in your life, Mika, to manage your external triggers for distraction, or that would normally distract you?
Completely ignore people when I don't want to get distracted. And then they're like,
F off.
Oh, I had this important thing. I'm like, well, I needed to get something done that was way more important, so I had to completely ignore all messages and emails.
Mm. I've been told I have resting bitch body. It's like I'll curl up into a ball like a roly-poly, you know, like a pill bug. I'm just like, don't you talk to me.
Yeah.
And I just, it's like I naturally just make myself look very unapproachable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I do it. I think I just do it instinctively.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the only way to get people to leave you alone sometimes, even in the library or in your office.
Oh God, at the gym. You know, like their entire like blog posts and videos of like how to talk to a woman wearing headphones at the gym. Dating tips for alpha males. It's like, how about you just don't?
Ew.
It's like, she doesn't want to be disturbed. Leave her the F alone. Mm.
Yeah. Because imagine those dudes, if you distracted them during their sets, they'd be so aggro.
Yeah. One part that stood out for me was around phones, you know, the phone things, like where your phone is. Because he recognizes that it's too simplistic to say, just ignore any external triggers that cross your path, right? But that's not realistic.
No.
But one example relating to phones that's just quickly mentioned in here is by having your phone in your field of view, your brain must work hard to ignore it. But if your phone isn't easily accessible or visually present, your brain is able to focus on the task at hand. Now, I don't disagree with that, but again, it depends on the context.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm trying to get work done that requires that I don't get distracted by my phone.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the thought that I might be missing some sort of important message or important notification can be really distracting.
Yes.
So for me, like having my phone in view with just my most important, like I try to manage my notifications well so that I'm not getting like disturbed by just random BS.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have this little voice in the back of my head going, oh, you should check your phone just in case. Check your phone just in case. Because like I don't need to check my phone because I know nothing's coming through because, you know, there it is.
Yeah. It also is quite presumptuous as to how much demand there is on you, external demands. Some people really have way too much on their shoulders because if you can't afford someone to look after your kids after school, or you can't afford to pay someone to fix your car, you got so many more demands on you, external distractions, your tax return is pretty low priority in the grand scheme of things, because you can't get to work without your car being fixed and your kids just simply can't be ignored.
Yeah. When I'm at my office and I'm trying to get work done, sometimes I'll get calls from my kids' school that I need to attend to immediately. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll get calls from clients or potential clients that I need to attend to immediately, because in some cases, missing that important phone call, that's potentially like thousands of dollars that mm-hmm. have just like flown out the window. Yep. And that's something I can't ignore as a business owner. As much as it would be lovely to say like, oh, you know, someone wants to contact you, they'll leave you a message, you can check your messages afterwards. It's like, no, A, I'm a millennial, I don't know how to check my voicemail. And B, a lot of times people won't bother leaving messages. And sometimes things are very, very time sensitive.
Yes.
And I will stress more worrying that I'm missing something important mm-hmm. than if it's just like there in my field of view.
Yeah.
And I guess one thing that this guy would absolutely hate is that I've constantly got something in my ears while I'm working.
Yeah.
Usually it's like some Netflix show that I've watched 1,000 times already, so I'm not focusing on the content, mm-hmm. but the sound, the familiarity, the voices, the tone is very soothing for the part of my brain that's always looking for external stimuli.
That's what I've noticed as well. I've always been someone who watches something while doing my homework or doing something else, because my mind is so busy, it wants to be doing those multiple things at once, and I need to kind of fulfill this social role that the television yeah. fulfills, that then I can actually focus on what I'm doing.
Yeah, I so worry someday that I'm going to see Daniel Levy just walking down the street and going to be like, oh, hey, man, how you going? Like, we're best friends or something. He's just going to be like, I don't know you. Stay away from me. It's like, no, but you don't understand. Like, Schitt's Creek is my comfort program. And, like, I've developed this parasocial bond with you that you must now honor. Otherwise, my whole life has been a lie.
Yeah.
And that's just something that works for some people. But there's this whole, like, cult of success that's like, no, you need silence and full focus, otherwise there's something wrong with you. It's like, hey, like, I'm neurodivergent. Whether you think that means there's something wrong with me is kind of a social judgment, because of the growing body of social research even that says, like, it's not a disorder, it's just a different way of processing information.
Exactly. And everyone's happy to take advantage of those different thoughts, different brain functions that have helped us in society and help us with how we work as a group. But when it's suddenly, oh, what, we have to make some adjustments so that you are also comfortable day to day, suddenly it's too much difficulty and you need to comply.
Yeah, stop being such a snowflake.
Yeah.
You're a woke snowflake because you need me to actually, like, think about something outside myself. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
That's how you feel. Rock and roll.
Snowflake in hell.
Snowflakes in hell. If I'm trying to get work done in an environment that is too free from distractions, I am then left at the mercy of the voices in my head.
Yeah.
And that's one reason that I need to have something playing in the background so it doesn't feel like I'm like dead.
Yeah.
Like, do you ever go into a room and it's just so quiet, it feels like the room has no life?
It's heavy. It's imposing.
It's a heavy feeling.
Yeah. Mm. I've also realized, like, I have the types of brain function. So there's kind of like analytical, and there's social, and creative, and that's about the only ones I've really identified. And I need each of those to be filled at any one time. Mm. So if I'm doing maths, I can't be also watching a show talking about numbers. Mm. It needs to be a show that's really like dull and just like silly social stuff. Like, I always called it like cheap American comedy. So these days I watch some British comedy as well. And If I'm sitting there chatting to someone, I can't just sit there and talk to someone. I have to play with something. I have to be doing something creative. I guess probably I need to fulfill two of those things at any one time. They can't cross over. It can't be two of the same thing.
Yeah. And for some people, it can create a different sort of tension in their social relationships, because you may appear to be distracted from the conversation you're having with someone, mm-hmm. when really you're engaging in something that helps you focus. Exactly. Like you with your crafts, or like me, gosh, mm-hmm. on the rare occasion that I need to speak to someone on the telephone. Do you remember, like telephones when you used to actually hold them up to your ear and like, go, yeah. Hey, how are you?
And I'm your arm fine. Would,
how are you?
And your arm would go numb while talking to your friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like even as a teenager,
mm-hmm.
like I would be scribbling something on a piece of paper, maybe drawing a picture, but at the very least, just scribbling.
Holding the phone because with your shoulder.
So
that you have both hands.
Yeah. And it's like I wasn't a brain surgeon in high school. Like I didn't have to have access to both hands in case of a life and death emergency. But if I didn't have some way for my hands to be doing something, it just did not feel right. Even just twirling the phone cord, you know?
Yes. And I guess when I'm making friendships and relationships, I just establish at the beginning, like, this is something I'm going to need. Like, if you need constant eye contact, this isn't going to work out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'd also find that really uncomfortable.
Yeah. And so we've touched on some of the social ramifications of being distracted or appearing distracted or having very, like, rigid expectations around attention and distraction. But let's talk about work. The workplace. Office environments. Gulags, if you will. Things in our professional histories that have been very distracting in a workplace, how we've managed that, how that aligns with Nir Eyal's insights here. Tell me a story, Mika.
I mean, the thing with work is there are demands that you can't ignore. Like if a client calls and wants to talk to you, you pretty much need to take it unless you really want to piss them off and lose the client. A coworker, if you're working on projects together and they have a question, like if you don't answer that, their workflow stops. So you need to stop what you're doing to answer that question so things can continue. And for me, before I had medication for ADHD, it was maybe a 10-20 minute turnaround from my hyperfocus being broken, me answering that question, then trying to get back. And I would kind of sit there flicking through tabs, trying to get back to where I was. And it just takes so long. Medication made that way easier. It's only a few minutes. But still, that break of focus is quite disruptive and emotionally dysregulating for me as well. Like it just kind of irritates me and starts my mood down. I guess that's probably one of the main things that I've experienced in a professional environment. In earlier jobs like retail and stuff, you're always having to break what you're doing to serve customers and then like go back to it when you're not got customers. But
yeah,
that's just part of the job.
Yeah. And I do appreciate that in the section about workplaces and distraction, there is the recognition that these things have to be addressed at a company-wide level. Like it's one thing to engage in personal strategies to make your coworkers leave you alone, for example. But if you're in an environment that doesn't allow for that to happen, it's like, well, it's a no-win situation. There is something, one chapter in this section, it's called Fixing Distraction is a Test of Company Culture. He brings up the issue of psychological safety. He writes, "The term psychological safety was coined by Dr. Amy Edmondson, an organizational behavioral scientist at Harvard. Edmondson defines psychological safety as a belief that one will not be punished or humiliated for speaking up with ideas, questions, concerns, or mistakes. Speaking up sounds easy, but if you don't feel psychological safety, you'll keep your concerns and ideas to yourself."
I mean, that's true.
Yeah. I left, before I started my business, I was in a workplace environment that was very unsafe psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
We're actively disincentivized for speaking up.
Wow.
Mm. And one of the issues that I had in that setting as well was the culture around distraction.
Yeah.
Like if I was marking papers or if I was doing something else, we were sometimes expected to do like a number of things all at once, for which we were only getting paid for a small portion of the time that we were spending, especially when it came to marking papers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you've got, and this is something that the union was constantly dealing with as well. It's like, you know, you've got these reports that to assess them well, it will take at least, you know, 45 minutes to really dive into how the student has like done all this and that. Mm-hmm. But you're only getting paid as if you spent 15 minutes on each paper.
Yes.
It's like, okay. And not only that, we're not going to do enough to ensure that you have a quiet working environment in which to do that.
Yeah.
Or that you are given optimal time within the work day to do that.
Yeah.
And all of these other things. Like, it was just, it was asinine.
Mm.
But I was constantly battling, and this wasn't just in my immediate last workplace. This is in previous, like, educational settings and such as well, where people just loved being distracting.
You're
and
right.
I was just constantly like, oh my gosh, please stop talking so loud. Stop asking me questions. Like, you don't understand. Like, you think it's a quick question, but it'll take me 20 minutes to get back on track. And then meanwhile, you've gone, you've trotted off into the sunset. You're living your life. And I'm here going, "Rrr."
It's extra frustrating when it was a question they didn't need answered by you. Like, they could have just Googled it, or they were being lazy.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder about these Silicon Valley companies, too, that have all this kind of extracurricular stuff inside the business. Like, you've got your hobby rooms and break rooms full of all these fun toys and stuff, and yet you also have this culture of expectation to have eyes seeing you there for ridiculous hours per day. Mm. Like, oh, if you're not here for 80 hours, you're really not trying. And crazy ideas like that, while they also actively put distractions in place.
Yeah.
So,
and the kinds of tools that people use to communicate in workplaces so that you've constantly got a line between you and a person that you want to communicate with. And again, because Nir Eyal is responsible for everything and everything's his fault, it's like, dude, explain to us exactly what your hand in creating this was.
Mm-hmm.
And then perhaps some of my skepticism around some of these methods that he brings up will dissipate somewhat.
Mm.
But again, he does not implicate himself at all in any of this. In fact, he goes a complete opposite direction.
And like, what are you supposed to do if you don't have a receptive workplace that is willing to work with you about these things? Yeah. You're just supposed to, I don't know, ignore your boss, get fired.
Yeah. But it's also the kind of workplace that he highlights here is very much like that white collar office environment.
Yeah.
Because, and that's what a lot of these books focus in on, when they talk about success, when they talk about anything to do with like an economical form of success or something, they paint this picture like the only valid occupation in any of this is corporate culture.
Yeah. And how many jobs are actually corporate? Like, to me, it seems like way more jobs are not.
Yeah. It's like, what about like warehouse staff and like culture and like the workplace culture there? What about people working in a retail environment? What about people whose work focuses mainly in on, you know, academia does get touched on a bit, but like customer service, hospitality, it's like those things don't exist in a lot of these worldviews.
I know.
Because it's like, well, who needs to cater to these groups? Who needs to recognize that like minimum wage workers as well could really benefit from some recognition that their company culture and their company leaders need to get their shit together too?
Not just that, but even like government employment laws and stuff aren't as protective towards people in those industries. Like in America, their minimum wage is ridiculous because they rely on tips. And even some of the books we've read, they actively like shit on jobs that are not at a certain level of, oh, you're in an office and you had to get a university education to work here and this sort of thing. And I'm my kind of opinion of that is you do not deserve to go eat at a restaurant or have things delivered to your house from a warehouse or have drivers drive you around if you do not respect those jobs as equally valid in our society.
Yeah,
our society only runs because of everyone having their position, and we need to make everyone feel like their job is worthy and rewarded as such.
Yeah, and that's something that comes up a bit in the section about children. There was a section and there was a line in there that I'm just like, oh, dude, come on.
Yeah.
But you're right. In workplace environments where there isn't enough protection around workers' rights, company culture and the ability to have that psychological safety where you can speak up and fight for ways for your job to be made easier to do or more feasible to complete, it's like, no, put a do not disturb sign on your computer. It's like, okay, so we're working with computers then.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, this is about people who work on computers all day. This is about people who are you know, making like significant financial transactions. He does mention the nurses wearing brightly colored vests when they are not to be disturbed so that there are fewer mistakes in issuing medications, which is great because it's an example of an environment where it can be life or death, quite literally.
And a job that is often overly strained, like overly demanding on their time, like there's just not enough time to do the jobs they're expected to do.
Yeah. And that's not to say that this book is completely invalid because it doesn't very specifically mention or like all the different categories of industries and stuff like that, but it is worth mentioning as a way to highlight like which echelon of society books like this are often targeted at.
Yeah, and it gives me the impression that he's never actually worked a retail job or a food service job or anything like that, because my experience there is you can make the most simple suggestion of, oh, if we moved that table out of the way, it would like increase our movement and reduce tripping hazards. Oh no, that would be like incredibly impossible to do. You ask for like the smallest thing and it's like, oh, you ask for everything, you're such a pain, like, and then you're rostered, you don't get rostered on very much if you start being at all difficult.
Yeah. some of the techniques that I use in my day-to-day life that are also mentioned in this book regarding avoiding too much interruption are things like batch processing email.
Mm.
You know, I don't nail it every time, but it's something that I strive to do. I check my email twice a day, 10 a.m., 2 p.m.
Yep.
I've got it in my email signature. This is my business-related email. I have it in my email signature that those are the times of the day where I check my email. And if there's anything like really urgent that someone needs to reach me about, they should send me a text message.
Yeah.
Right? And one reason I've done this is because I know that if I'm checking my email at those times of the day, I'm not going to be like distracted by every little ping that comes through. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. like I'm going to assume that this is super important. It's like, no, it's not. So that's something that helps me. And yeah, I do often check my email outside of those times, but it's a way of managing other people's expectations.
Exactly. If people have a minimum expectation, anything you do on top of that is up to you, but you can't have... You have a reason if they come to you saying, why haven't you checked the email? You say, because this is the boundary that I set.
Yeah.
And I will only meet that expectation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something that wasn't always an option when I was working for someone else.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially when I had students who just really wanted me to be at their beck and call. And it's no wonder then that there are so many movements now to take back our leisure time outside of our workplaces, to mm-hmm. have these very specific boundaries on employers to say like, well, no, you can't, you know, not roster me on, or you can't fire me for not responding to your text message at 1 a.m. because that's not, because that's outside of the scope of my workday.
Yes.
Ugh. Mm. But
how irritating.
Yes.
It's got me worked up. Let's talk about something else.
Yeah, let's talk about something much less challenging, like children.
Oh, of course.
That's never stressful.
They're not distracting yeah. at all.
Where he focuses on children in the context of distraction isn't so much about like avoiding the distraction of children as it is about raising indistractable children.
Mm-hmm.
It's also as if we needed to be reminded that we are the problem. This is the section that really does that. This is part six. It's like, yeah, like there are these digital devices that we've designed to get your kids hooked, but you parents, it's your responsibility to parent your children. And it's like, dude, this is nothing new. Like people who have marketed to children, marketed like unhealthy foods to children, or marketed very problematic toys and games to children, like throughout history, have always turned it back and like, oh, well, you know, you're supposed to parent your children. It's not our responsibility. Like, it's nothing new. It's
yeah.
just using some slightly different examples and vocabulary. That's what part six is all about.
Yeah.
He brings up historical examples of moral panics to again downplay the significance of social media and modern forms of screen time on the well-being of our kids. On page 215, the last paragraph, he writes, innovations and new technologies are another frequent target of blame. When we're talking about blaming children for bad behavior, right? So in 1474, Venetian monk and scribe Filippo di Strada used a polemic against another handheld information device, stating, the printing press, a whore. An 1883 medical journal attributing rising rates of suicide and homicide to the new educational craze, proclaiming, insanity is increasing with education, and that education would exhaust the children's brains and nervous systems, In 1936, kids were said to have developed the habit of dividing attention between the humdrum preparation of their school assignments and the compelling excitement of the radio loudspeaker, according to the music magazine Gramophone. So again, it's going into this whole like, no, this, like, these problems have existed forever. It's not about the modern devices. It's not about this. It's not about that. It's about the kids. It's about the parents. It's about you and your behaviors. It's like, it's not, it's a false equivalency.
I'm imagining like a 1950s child trying to go to sleep and their board game coming in and jumping up into their face and like, have you thought of playing me right now? Bring, bring. Hello there, child. Well, hello there.
No, you're supposed to use the HAL 9000 voice. Hello there, child. Come play me.
Play, child, play.
I am your friend. And I think people who hadn't come across those examples in this context before reading this book might go, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. But it's a Trojan horse, because then it leads into all this stuff saying, you know, social media isn't actually bad for kids. And this is another Nereye Eyal versus Tristan Harris theme. It's like, which studies are we actually pointing to back up our claims? Like, are we cherry-picking things that are supporting our own narratives? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that, yes, this guy is cherry-picking stuff because, you know, he's not the problem.
Yeah.
But we've already decided that he's at fault for everything. On page 217, he issues a direct critique of studies related to screen time. So he writes this. A closer read of the studies linking screen time with depression finds correlation only with extreme amounts of time spent online. Teenage girls who spent over 5 hours per day online tended to have more depressive or suicidal thoughts, but common sense would have us ask whether the kids who have a propensity to spend excessive amounts of time online might also have other problems in their lives.
Well, yeah.
Perhaps 5 hours a day on any form of media is a symptom of a larger problem.
I mean, I would say it's a bit of a self-feeding problem. I do think that a reason to spend that much time online probably comes from something, but then it sucks you in and keeps you spiraling.
Yeah. It's really weak sauce to critique studies about screen time with the argument of common sense.
Yeah.
It's like you're not giving us like evidence that states otherwise. You're saying common sense, like everyone knows. No smart person wouldn't think to agree with what I'm about to say next.
He would have easily been able to find evidence of what he's trying to back up, I think, that you're more likely to seek social interaction if you're not getting it elsewhere. You know, that could be something to back that up. But he hasn't.
And he kind of touches on like other stuff relating to the studies, but it's very clear what he's trying to show here. Social media is not the problem. There are other problems that people have. It reminds me so much of, I know it's kind of gross to compare all this to gun violence and stuff like that, but it's like when people say like, oh, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. It's like, okay, people with guns kill people.
I mean, you know? It is actually a fairly good comparison in that people have always had problems. There's always been a propensity to get angry and lash out. But then once you added this extra element, it made that problem so much worse. Like, before someone would get into a fist fight and, you know, occasionally kill someone with that, But then when guns became easily accessible, someone can now has a very easy way to cause far more harm than was previously done.
Yeah. So even if we're looking at these kids who have other problems in their lives, they now have this like unprecedented access to information, to potentially harmful information, to communities that might be exploitative, to a lot of different things, or even just taking them out of their own reality. It's like, I'm not saying that we should then like take away social media from the kids, but the way it's written here, it's like shifting the blame away. Constantly, he does this in the book, shifting the blame away, distracting people, ironically, because again, the title of the book is Indistractable. It's like he's actively distracting people from a very important source of the problem.
Yeah.
And he has these very particular ways that he wants parents to engage with their children around these things. And even where he recognizes that social media and use of technology can cause some problems, it's like it's this immediate deflection and this piling on with other examples that just seems really disingenuous. Okay. You know, he cites other research that says that overuse of technology is a symptom of something being wrong in other areas of life, like school or home. It's like, if those things are fixed, then the screen time issue won't be as much of a problem. It's like, okay, well, we're not really saying that that's not a thing. But again, it's saying, no, go fix those things. It's like, that is a much bigger conversation than we can have in this book that is really just a bunch of blog posts stitched together.
I mean,
right?
I was a kid that had some emotional struggles and social struggles, and I would read books as my outlet, but those books didn't have an algorithm that fed me more, telling me that I'm a terrible person that needs to fix all these problems, or actively sends me negative echo chambers. I had some sort of autonomy in those decisions of what to read.
Yeah. And for me, growing up in the 90s and being a kid, I graduated in 1999, so you know, I was very much at that cusp of like having an offline life and an online life.
Yeah.
For me, engaging with online communities was a really helpful lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because of like a lot of the darkness that I experienced in my day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. But again, like you were saying, we didn't have the same vulnerabilities to these algorithms that were targeting us constantly.
Yeah.
Like you had to do things a lot more intentionally. And I did have a lot of other problems that like pushed me to spend a lot of time online. But if we constantly say, no, don't ignore like the obvious thing here, go back to the root of the problem. It's like, you know, we can do both things.
Mm.
But if we say that it's just this and not this, it's like, yeah, dude, we know what you're up to. Okay, stop. He's saying like, no, be better parents. That is the constant narrative here. Okay. He does offer some useful insights in terms of working with your children in understanding like their need for these technologies and working together to come up with agreements and solutions for how the kids will use these things. And I like that it puts more of the power in the hand of the child to say like, okay, this works. It's not just throwing rules at them that are going to make them rebel.
Yeah.
Like that I fully support. And that's something that we've worked with our 7-year-old on like, you know, for a couple of years now since we started allowing her to engage with screens in a more independent way. But, you know, there's always a but. This is another one of Leslie's big buts.
And
this is
lie.
How the section links back to what we were talking about with the kinds of workplaces that are seen as more valid in this, in the self-help personal development genre. In this example, he was recounting a conversation with a friend who was a mother of twin teenage boys. And she was saying, like, my kids are obsessed with Fortnite. They can't stop. You know, they're addicted, this and that, blah, 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 and asked for his advice. And this is the paragraph where he gives the advice. He says, my advice involved a few unorthodox ideas. First, I advised her to have a conversation with her sons and to listen to them without passing judgment. Okay?
Yep.
Potential questions to ask included the following. Is keeping up with their schoolwork consistent with their values? Do they know why they are being asked to do their homework? What are the consequences of not doing their assignments? Are they okay with those consequences, both short-term, example, getting a bad grade, and long-term, example, settling for a low-skilled job?
Filthy.
I was like, oh, why'd you have to go there, bro?
Yeah. And I mean, also, the kid's going to be like, yeah, I'm going to be an esport champion. I don't need to have schoolwork.
Yeah. I'm picturing, like, the kinds of teenage kids I grew up with, or even teenagers I've interacted with, like, in recent years. It's like they're sitting there just ready to just nod their heads and, like, bow to the wisdom of this mother who's asking, like, is keeping up with your schoolwork consistent with your values? It's like, I don't fucking know my values, biatch.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, like, if I they're don't... really, like, if she's already feeling so disconnected to her kids because of this, like, addiction they supposedly have, like, how is this conversation going to play out in reality?
Yeah, I think I was a fairly thoughtful kid, and I don't think I could have told you what my values were specifically when I was a teenager.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's not worth trying this kind of thing. Like, sure, give it a try. Like, you know your kids better than anyone else, but the way he lays out all of this stuff, it's like, these are simple solutions. Don't need to go any deeper.
Yeah.
But settling for a low-skilled job...
It's like
the consequences of not doing your assignments. Again, it's directly linking the kind of work that you can get with the kind of educational success you've attained.
Yeah.
It's not that simple.
No.
If you look at someone in a quote unquote low skilled job and assume, oh, they just didn't do very well at school, it's like, you're an a-hole.
Well, a lot of these people
could be very well educated. They could be very smart. They could have a lot of other circumstances that have led them down this path, or they can have actively chosen this particular line of work because it aligns with something that they value and how they want to spend their time in and outside of work.
That breaks down his worldview, his meritocracy worldview. And if that happened, he would have to admit that life is a little more nuanced and that it's not easy to just disregard people in low-skilled jobs and not respect them or treat them as equals.
Yeah. But whatever. The problem is that they were just too distracted. They're not part of the indistractable half of society. In chapter 32, labeled "Help Them with External Triggers," it's again, it's like, let's just blame the parents. Let's blame the parents. Let's not admit my role in any of this at all. Mm-hmm. He writes, according to a Pew Research Center 2015 study in the United States, 95% of teens now report they have a smartphone or access to one. Not surprisingly, 72% of parents whose kids have a smartphone are concerned they pose too much distraction. And pose too much distraction is in quotes. Mm-hmm. Next paragraph. In many ways, it is parents and guardians who have enabled this situation. After all, it is we who gave permission and often provided the funds to purchase the distracting devices we've come to resent. We've bowed to our kids' demands in ways that may not benefit them or our households. Many parents don't consider whether their child is ready for a device with potentially damaging consequences and give in to the protestation that, quote, everyone in my class has a smartphone and an Instagram account. And then he makes a comparison to kids standing at the edge of a swimming pool. And you know that they don't know how to swim. So what do you do? You know, it's like, do you like throw them in the pool, or do you pull them back and recognize that they don't know how to swim? So you're not going to go let them drown. It's like, dude, how can you make that comparison? It's like, first of all, if you're one of the top thought leaders in this whole, like, how to create habit-forming products world, companies have been using your model to make everyone want these programs, want these devices, and then you're saying, hey, I just caused the problem. Well, no, you're not saying that. You're saying, like, hey, it's your responsibility to resist the pull of this, like, mega multi-billion dollar industry that's actively coming for you and your kids.
That's bypassing the swimming teachers, basically.
Yeah. It's like that. It's those elements of this book that just make me sick. Mm. Like, legitimately. As much as there are things that can be useful, that can... Like, if you don't dive into Nir Eyal's history and the influence he's had in creating this problem, you can get a lot of valuable information from this book that you might be able to implement in your family.
Yeah.
Even in isolation, I think the book isn't terrible. Mm-hmm. There's good advice in here, but...
Just as a whole, it kind of gives a picture of a certain worldview that I find not so comfortable.
Yeah, he does tell us a little more about his daughter when she was 5 years old and she wanted iPad time, and how how they strategized around that, saying they were explaining about how spending too much time with apps and videos meant she couldn't play with her friends as much. And then this paragraph really got me. He writes, we also explained that the apps and videos on the iPad were made by some very smart people and were intentionally designed to keep her hooked and habitually watching. It's important that our kids understand the motives of the gaming companies and social networks. While these products sell us fun and connection, they also profit from our time and attention. This might seem like a lot to teach a five-year-old, but we felt a strong need to equip her with the ability to make decisions about her screen usage and enforce her own rules. Do you think the next paragraph explains, like, what his part in all of this is? No, not at all.
I mean, he said it.
Goes into
It was like a very smart person.
Yeah. Some very smart people. Me.
Yeah.
Me and my buddies are trying to keep you hooked. He even used the word hooked here.
Yep.
It's like your daddy is the boogeyman, kid.
Yeah.
It's like he's pulling the wool over your eyes. Don't let it happen. But then he describes this whole thing. It's like, you know, we asked her how much screen time per day she thought was good for her. You know, we asked her this, blah, blah, blah. We, you know, we discussed politics for a while. And, you know, we made some duck a l'orange together. And she's a very sophisticated, very well-developed child. And so all of this was not beyond her understanding whatsoever. Mm. And whoever else doesn't operate this way is just inferior. It's like, okay, okay, right. He does say that, you know, these strategies aren't a guarantee of parent-child domestic harmony, but that these discussions are still worth having. And again, yes, they are, but, and this is where I'll start to close this whole discussion. As useful as some of this information is, we cannot keep perpetuating this narrative that the onus is on the consumers of the technology to manage their own use of the technology without addressing the systems that are driving these things. The amount of money that is put into researching how to keep people, a lot of this money going to Nir Eyal, by the way.
Yeah.
To understand how to keep people coming back for more and more and more.
Yeah.
And the people who suffer most, of course, are the people who lack the resources to push back against these things.
Yes. It's actually reminding me a lot of the environmental impact of corporations and the constant message that it's the individual consumers that need to change and stop waste and stop the environmental impact, yeah, while giving a complete pass to the corporations on actually mm-hmm. producing those and making it almost impossible to consume products that are needed or highly desired without creating those problems.
Yeah. And then when these companies do like the smallest little thing to make it look that like they're helping combat the problems that they created, mm-hmm. it becomes headline news. It gets splashed across the sky.
Yep.
Kind of like companies like McDonald's saying, oh, we're not using plastic straws anymore in our effort to completely decimate the rainforests. It's like, now we're using paper. It's like, what exactly do you think that's going to have? What kind of impact do you think that's really going to have on the problem that you are continuing to be complicit in?
Yeah. There's...
And with the digital devices, it's like, you know, you can use like the screen time measuring functions for various apps and this and that. You can opt out of, you can mute your group chats. You can opt out of this and this and this. You can unsubscribe from all of these emails. You can, like, you've got options. The button is right there. It's simple. That's his attitude about the whole thing. It's like, okay, but that's not...
That's
not good enough.
Like, as a person with less means, I have to buy secondhand a lot. And Facebook has now co-opted all of the secondhand market, at least here. And so I end up having to be on Facebook just to buy a secondhand item, which then I'm then fighting their algorithms again of them shoving things in my face and taking my time away.
Yeah. And same, like, as a business owner, like, you kind of, it's not impossible to exist as a business owner without an online presence on social media, but the kind of business that I have, it certainly, that'd be doing things on extremely, extremely hard mode to not do that.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not like we can just, like, completely opt out and kumbaya our way through society. It's like, it would take, like, a lot of cooperation from a lot of people to say, we're going to fight against this together, and we're going to nurture our networks in real life in a way that doesn't require us to use social media. But it's like, we're there are way too many moving parts now to allow that to happen.
Yes, unless you go very extreme in going to live on an off-grid community or something.
Yeah, but even then, you're self-selecting yourself out of something.
Exactly.
That, in theory, like, if there were better systems in place to... My go-to solution to things is rarely like, oh, there should be more government oversight. It's like, it's not what I'm saying exactly. But to have just more... To be able to hold a lot of these companies accountable for their impact more.
Yeah.
Tristan Harris, my love, this is why I so appreciate the work that you are doing. So if you are out there, mwah, big kisses to you. Yeah.
Yeah, things have got a little out of hand just generally with the level that capitalism has reached in our society, in my opinion, where it just seems completely unregulated and unrestrained. Yeah. There isn't even like proper competition anymore, which means it's not capitalism anymore. So
yeah,
it's just dictatorships.
Yeah. So what can we say to our intersectional friends and people who look at books like this,
well,
and just don't see themselves in it, but still want strategies for being able to control their own attention and choose their lives?
I guess I would say, from my perspective, looking at lots of strategies on how to approach that is a really good way to find what works for you and not take it as like law that if you can't do this one method, that you can't find a way to be less distracted or be able to concentrate more on the things that are important to you. You can also look at your values and try and decide on where you want to put your attention more so, which is very difficult when you have a lot of demands on you and it always feels like you're having to give your attention to the things that are less important because the world demands it. Like, my government forms and tax returns and stuff are not high on my priority list, but they are required of me. Yeah. So then I just have to look at what's on my plate and what can I get rid of so that I can make space and time for those things that I find important. And frankly, in regards to privilege, some people might not be able to empty their plate enough to get to those things that are really up there as big goals that they want to build towards. And I don't really have an answer for how we get around to that at this point in time. Short of revolution, I'm not sure that everyone's going to have those opportunities. And I'm sorry that that's all I've got for you on that. But I guess you can make decisions in life like, I'm downsizing my life. I'm getting rid of a lot of belongings. I'm moving into smaller place, reducing what is demanded of me.
Yeah.
So that I have more time for these things I really want to do, like study. So I'm just trying to get some of those base things out of the way and sort it out so that I can try and reach those goals.
Yeah.
And
I think that is actually really helpful, what you were just saying. Like, there isn't necessarily one go-to solution for how to make these concepts fit for everyone. But by making adjustments so that you can simplify, I don't like the word simplify in this context, so that you can reduce some of the responsibilities that you have, even if that means outsourcing certain tasks, if you have the means to do that. Like, that is a valid way of taking back control of your time and attention. If you need to get assessed for like ADHD or autism or something, and if you have the means to do that, it could be one way of understanding more about why you might not be able to focus on things, or you have a different relationship with being distracted than a lot of other people that you might know. There could be some executive dysfunction happening in there that you don't know about. If it's not an open conversation within your social circles, then you might not even know what it is. Like, I'm saying these words and it's like, Leslie, what the fuck are you talking about? It's like, Google it. See if it sounds like you.
Especially because your family often all behave in a certain way and it might be dysfunctional, but it doesn't mean that that is the norm or what should be done either. So it's okay to break away and decide that you don't want to live that same pattern, I guess.
Yes. And it's also important to recognize that if you do try these different techniques to avoid distraction, to become one of the indistractable, and it doesn't work for you, it could just be that you need to use a different technique.
Absolutely.
Or it could be that this isn't the right thing for you right now, at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I'll give you an example from my life. You know, things like time boxing don't work when I'm feeling super depressed or when I'm like deep in my luteal phase. When I'm feeling a lot more myself, then I can actually look at my schedule on a more like as a whole over a period of time with a lot more clarity than, you know, right after I ovulate. Then everything's just like, woo, just moving scribbles on a page. It's like, oh, this isn't going to work.
No.
And it's okay to put one system on the shelf and then revisit it at another time. Like, that's okay.
Yep.
And of course, we cannot ignore the fact that you are battling against major corporations who have a lot of vested interest in perpetuating and strengthening these technologies to keep you hooked. The problem isn't you as an individual. You are fighting a battle against a very powerful entity. That doesn't mean it's not worth trying. It just means, like, give yourself some friggin' grace.
Yeah. And it's not just the apps. It's everything. It's we walk outside and there's billboards and there's papers and there's just everything you seem to encounter is fighting for attention, and there's been hundreds of years of them perfecting this.
Yeah.
And yeah, so exactly. We have to realize that we're living in a world that is very different to what our ancestors lived in.
Yeah.
In regards to attention, many things are much, much better. And I'm not going to say I want to live in the past, but just in regards to attention and blaming ourselves for how hard it is now, we need to remember that we didn't evolve for this. This has been a very fast change in our society.
Yeah. And we don't know what's coming. We don't know how much more powerful this machine is going to be, especially with AI developing in the way that it is. Like, we don't know.
Yeah.
So we do have a level of personal responsibility towards making decisions with ourselves about how we will proceed. But
exactly.
That's only one piece of the puzzle.
We can't control the way the world is changing around us. We can only control how we choose to interact with it.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that is making the decisions harder and bigger decisions.
Yeah. And this is where getting in touch with our truest core values is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And also deepening our capacity for critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And for having the confidence to develop and protect our boundaries.
Absolutely.
And also read Stolen Focus. Because Johan Hari goes into this stuff in much more depth than we can.
Yes.
In this particular format.
The more you can understand how you're being influenced and manipulated, the more you're able to protect yourself from it.
Yeah. Yeah. So how you feeling, Mika?
I mean, I would say a little bit gloomy, but not really, because I've been through the kind of realization that I have to just personally pull back from quite a lot of these things, and I'm quite happy with that decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, I lose touch a lot more, and people are like, how have you not heard? And I'm like, I don't know, because it's not important to me. Like,
yeah.
Which celebrity died yesterday is not the top of my priority list. And so,
yeah
I'm a few days behind, a week behind, whatever. That's all right. Like, I don't need to be on top of everything that isn't actually a priority in my life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I actually feel quite at peace with the idea of being just less connected with certain things, because it's actually deepening my relationships with people who really matter to me. I get to spend real quality time instead of this shallow skimming over hundreds of people.
And it is absolutely okay, and I give you permission to remove yourself from any Facebook group that uses the at everyone function. I hate that so much. Okay, so we've got a quote to close on, Mika.
Oh wait, I've got one for you.
Do you now?
The key to success is to focus our conscious minds on things we desire, not things we feel.
Okay, sounds a bit generic, but
it's by Brian Tracy.
Who said that one? Oh God!
Your favorite person.
Get that shit out of my ears.
Okay, let's have a real quote.
Okay. All right. So my quote to close this session comes from Vivian Westwood, who, of course, was a very world-famous fashion designer from the UK. She passed away in 2022. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Recent.
Quite recently, yeah. A lot of times when people think Vivian Westwood, they associate her style with, like, punk new wave and and that kind of thing. She does have a history of political involvement and activism around things like climate change, and, you know, big supporter of Julian Assange. And it's interesting because she started to adopt these very kind of anti-consumerist messages with the recognition that a lot of the business that she was involved in was like a direct contributor to a lot of the problems relating to consumerism and climate change. So anyway, the quote is this: "The age in which we live, this nonstop distraction, is making it more impossible for the young generation to ever have the curiosity or discipline, because you need to be alone to find out anything."
Yep.
Yeah. Like, it's okay to not be completely, to not be constantly stimulated by shiny objects. Well, yes. Well, I don't know my.
So, Leslie, how can people find us?
Well, if you want to keep up with our shenanigans, the best thing to do is to go to my Instagram, Leslie V Coaching, or my website, leslievcoaching.com. You can keep up with all of our latest episodes as they're released. You can get in touch with us. Let us know if there are specific books you'd like us to discuss. And you can also book a free introductory life coaching consultation with me, which we can do in person here in Brizzy or online.
Awesome.
So thank you, Mika, and thank you to our listeners for joining us for yet another rousing, stimulating conversation about books and such. That's an IT crowd reference. And we will see you again in Chapter 8. Bye-bye.
Bye.